My father's involvement in the First World War started as a 19-year-old. He went out to France in 1915, and as a captain, he won the Military Cross. At his funeral in 1951, when I was 16, it was mentioned he'd also been recommended for a Victoria Cross during his military service. So he was a true hero.
My own father had a brother called Philip. He was a twin brother. And like all twins, they all tend to do things together, and they went off to the Great War together. My uncle Philip was killed in 1917, and my father thought he wanted to pay his own respects to his brother by visiting his grave, so he went on the original pilgrimage organised by the British Legion, as it was called then, in 1928.
A decade after the end of the First World War, 11,000 British Legion veterans and war widows and other family members set out on a pilgrimage to the battlefields and cemeteries of the Western Front. The tour was 3 days long and it ended in a service of remembrance at the Menin Gate, which had been opened just the year before. And the date of this special ceremony was the 8th of August 1928, which coincided with the 10th anniversary of the Battle of Amiens, the start of the 100-day offensive that ended the First World War. Now, as we know, organised tours of the battlefields had become very popular during the immediate post-war years, but for veterans, this was a chance, many of them, to return to places that they knew well and to pay their respects to their fallen comrades. And for the relatives of the dead, the tours provided the first and possibly the only opportunity to visit the grave or the new memorials of a loved one that was situated so far from home. So welcome to another episode. I think this is the 66th episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And a couple of weeks ago, I recorded a podcast about people returning to the battlefield, veterans returning to the battlefields after the war. And it's proved to be a very popular episode, and it's one that's intrigued me. For lots of people, they're often fascinated by what happened to the battlefields immediately after the war and right up to the 20-year period and just before the start of the Second World War. And it made me think about an experience that I had in 2018 when I was part of the Ledger Battlefields tours that guided the Royal British Legion members in what they called GP90. It was the British Legion's biggest membership event in modern history. And what they wanted to do, and indeed what they did do, was recreate that first enormous tour that had taken place 90 years before. They called it GP90. And during this tour, we did exactly the same as what those veterans did in 1928. We spent 2 days touring the battlefields. And then on the 8th of August 2018, on the very day, that very anniversary, 1,100 standard bearers of the Royal British Legion from different branches up and down the country marched through the Grote Market in Ypres towards the Menin Gate. In all, there were 2,200 members of the Legion that took part in this tour. I think there was 50 or 60 different coaches, and each one was being guided by different battlefield guides. And as I say, I was one of those guys that was fortunate or lucky enough to be accompanying these Legion members around the battlefields for this unforgettable trip. So in this week's podcast, what I wanted to do was to look back at 1928 and see exactly what happened on that first big great pilgrimage. And to help me do this, I managed to find a book. And it was called The British Legion Battlefield Pilgrimage 1928, The Echoes of the Great War. And I've chosen sections of that to read to you today so you get an idea of what those veterans thought when they attended this ceremony. And then we're going to wind the clock back 90 years and we're going to go and talk about what happened when we visited Ypres in the 90-year, the GP90 event, and look at the experience, the thoughts of some of those people that were part of that tour. And the opening words of this podcast were just a few of the memories and the thoughts of those British Legion members that they recorded after they returned home. But before we do that, I want to talk about something that I experienced yesterday. when I was fortunate enough to be given a guided tour of the Royal Hospital in Chelsea. And this is where nearly 300 army veterans live. And these are men that have served in Korea and the Falkland Islands in 1982, Cyprus and Northern Ireland troubles, and also in World War II. And there are other soldiers that live there that may not have served in any campaigns, but they've all been soldiers at some time in their life. And they've got to the stage in life where they need some help with their living. So they move into the Royal Hospital in Chelsea, and it's an incredible historic site in itself. It's a Grade 1 and Grade 2 listed site, and it's a beautiful architectural legacy that was left to the Royal Hospital by Charles II. And it was Sir Christopher Wren that designed much of the site. Of course, he went on to design St Paul's Cathedral. And whilst I was wandering around the site, I noticed various plaques, as you would expect, on the wall. And one of them said that it was in memory of those pensioners and residents of the Royal Hospital that lost their lives within the precincts of the hospital by enemy action in the two world wars. And there were details of the Ludlow family that were all killed on the 16th of February 1918. And head of the family was an Ernest Ludlow, Military Cross, Captain in the Grenadier Guards, and listed below his name was his wife, Jessie, two sons, Ernest and Bernard, and Alice Copley, who was their niece, his niece. So me being me, I had to find out what had happened. I asked the Chelsea pensioner that was taking us around who this man was and how he came to be killed here, and he showed me a building that was rebuilt on the site of where the Ludlow family had lived. And one dark night in February 1918, the building was completely demolished by a heavy 1,000-pound bomb dropped by a Gotha German plane, and the entire family was wiped out. So when I got home, I did a bit more digging, and I found a newspaper report that gives even more details about this horrific event. So who was this man, Ernest Ludlow? He'd been born in Dartford in Kent in 1876 and had been working as a labourer when in 1894 he enlisted in the Grenadier Guards. He was soon promoted to Lance Corporal and then was promoted to Sergeant during the South African Boer War. He was still serving with the army when war broke out in 1914 and was mentioned in dispatches in October 14. And then awarded the Military Cross in January of 1915. He was then wounded in August 1916, and suffering from shell shock, he was invalided back to the UK and actually worked at the Royal Hospital as a staff member in August of 1917. And that's why he was living there with his family just a few months later in February 1918. So what happened on that awful evening? Well, a report in the West London Press on the 22nd of February gives us some details of what happened. It says an inquest upon the bodies of an invalided officer aged 41, his wife Jessie, who was 37, Ernest 10, Bernard 4, and Alice Copley, who were killed on Saturday night, was held at the coroner on Wednesday. A witness identified the body of his brother, Ernest, aged 41, and those of the family. A witness said that after the warning had been given, he saw the captain go through his front door, which he closed behind him. The witness was about 12 yards away from the home, not more than 2 minutes later, when an explosive was dropped at the back of the deceased's house. The witness looked around, he saw the dust fly up and the house collapsed. A police inspector said about 10:10 p.m. he was in the police station when he heard a very loud explosion. He afterwards went to the place in a motor car, and he found that two houses had been demolished and two others severely damaged. He found that the family in one of the demolished houses was safe. Digging operations were commenced at once, and the first child, aged about 7 months, who is still alive, was recovered in a few minutes and was moved to a hospital. The body of Bernard was found impaled on the railings of a house some distance away. At 11:40 p.m, Lawrence, aged 6, Gerald, aged 8, and Ernest, aged 10, were recovered from the debris, all alive, and taken to the hospital, but Ernest was found to be dead on arrival. The other two were still alive, and at 3:50 a.m. on the 17th, the body of Mist. Miss Copley was recovered from the basement, and at 3:50 p.m. on the 18th, the bodies of Captain Ludlow and his wife were recovered from the basement and all were dead. A police sergeant spoke about finding the mutilated body of Bernard, this was the four-year-old son, on the railings of a house some distance from the demolished house. Another constable said at 10:10 p.m. he heard a great swishing noise through the air, followed by an explosion which threw him to the ground. He got up and went to the nearest telephone and reported to the police, and the witness said he saw the body of a boy on the railings about 50 yards away from the scene of the explosion. The inspector recalled and said that the children had gone to bed on the first floor. The two who survived were somewhat protected by the bedclothes folding around them. He thought the parents and their niece, Miss Copley, were in the basement kitchen. It was a most violent explosion, and the boy Bernard was apparently blown from the bedroom. The medical evidence showed that the wife died from suffocation and the three other victims from injuries caused by the explosion and the fall in masonry. And the jury returned a verdict to the effect that the victims died through the explosion of a bomb dropped by enemy aircraft. What an awful situation that is. He's served his country through two wars with distinction, awarded several military honours. He's then invalided, suffering from shell shock, come back to the United Kingdom. He's gone into the Royal Hospital at Chelsea, which even yesterday felt like a very safe place, very quiet and protected. From yesterday, it felt like we were protected from all the noise of the traffic and everything else that goes on in London these days. And he must have felt protected from World War One when he moved into that house within the grounds of the Royal Hospital. But war, and especially World War One, is indiscriminate, isn't it? Thankfully, he wouldn't have known anything about it. It's horrific what happened to the young four-year-old boy. And again, you can only hope that he didn't know much about it and hope that he was killed by the explosion and not by the impact on those railings. Ernest Ludlow and his family are now buried in the Brookwood Cemetery in Surrey. And he doesn't have a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone. He has a memorial cross which was erected by the officers of the Grenadier Guards in memory of Captain Ludlow. And the cross also lists the other members of his family that died. And it says, in affectionate remembrance of a brave and esteemed comrade. We often say that we're still surrounded in the 21st century by the Great War. And this is another example of that. You've got to keep your eyes peeled, haven't you, wherever you go. Find these memorials, and then you find a story that sits behind it. But now let's go back to 1928 and that Royal British Legion Great Pilgrimage. The introduction to the tour was written by a Lieutenant Colonel John Buchan, who, when he wrote this in 1928, was a Member of Parliament. And he said a pilgrimage to the battlefields should have two feelings behind it. One is a fortified optimism. There is an optimism which is more merciless than any pessimism, an optimism which sees clearly all the difficulties and dangers of the path and yet dares to hope. That is the optimism which won the war. That is the lesson which our dead have taught us. The other feeling is more ready sympathy for our fellows. Victory was won at a great price, and many of our neighbours are still paying it in sorrow, which will only end with death. Those who, with their own eyes, have seen the campaign in ground and the tangible evidence of the cost at which our empire and our civilization were defended must return with a stronger courage and a readier pity. Now, for this special tour, as I said, there was 11,000 pilgrims that made their way over to France and Belgium, and they went in trains that carried 500 people in each one. And arrangements were made by the Royal British Legion for people to get from their home to the Western Front and back again. They were given a handbook, and inside the handbook was a cheap fare voucher for use on English railways. Then there was a combined railway ticket and a special passport for the pilgrimage. So they didn't actually have to have a passport. The Legion have even arranged a temporary passport for their use just for this trip. Then there was a detailed timetable and instructions for the people in their party that covered the entire pilgrimage from London and to the ports of embarkation and over to France and Belgium. and there were three luggage labels. And at the bottom of the page, it says, if you lose your ticket, tell your company conductor at once. He'll obtain a fresh ticket for you. With the number of people involved, it was impossible for them all to go on one ferry or even from one port. There were, in fact, three routes. The first one went from Harwich to Zeebrugge, and it was to take 7 hours overnight, and cabin accommodation was arranged for the pilgrims. The next one was from Tilbury to Dunkirk, 6 hours. There was a proportion of cabin accommodation, but there wasn't enough cabins for everybody. Just 250 berths were available, and the Legion had to make the decision as to who would be suitable for those cabins. And then there was the traditional route that many of us take today, Dover to Calais. And that crossing was to take, as it does now, 1.5 hours. There were meals provided on the longer crossings from Tilbury and Harwich, but not on the Dover to Calais. And there was no berths available either. They wouldn't need them, would they? But the Legion did arrange for them to have a buffet lunch at Dover, and then when they arrived in Calais, so they weren't going to go hungry. Let's hope they didn't give them bully beef at these buffets. That would have been ironic, wouldn't it? Now, when we do battlefield tours now with Ledger or any coach tour, quite often people want to go away from the main route and make special visits to cemeteries where they may have relatives buried there or other people that they're interested in. Sometimes it's not always possible, especially if we don't know in advance. And this was a problem that the Legion had at the time. It says a considerable number of pilgrims have applied to visit particular cemeteries. No further applications can be received after the 15th of June, so that's about 2 months before the tour, because they had to arrange transport. And because of budget issues, they had to allow these special visits to cemeteries that were within either 25 miles of the Somme or Vimy Ridge, or within just 5 miles of Ypres, which, as you know, will have covered many of the cemeteries up on the Passchendaele Ridge. Now, when we go over to the battlefields now, it's simple when it comes to currency. We just use the euro. But I can remember a time when we were using Belgian francs that were different to French francs. And this is a problem that the pilgrims had then. So the Legion produced a table showing them the currency conversions between English, French and Belgium. And it also warned them that many of the roads are what the French call pavé, or cobbles as we call them, except in the larger towns, and it told the veterans to wear thick soles or essential to avoid sore feet. And for the women, well, I think it's the women, high heels are discouraged because they'll get damaged. And it also tells you to bring soap because it will not normally be provided, it says, in the hotels. These are the things that we take for granted these days. Those pavé roads in most cases are gone now, replaced by modern tarmac. So over the first 2 days, they went in their thousands to the Somme, and they alighted the train at Beaucourt station, which still stands to this day, although it's not used. It's a ruin, it's still there. And from there, they trudged around the battlefields on foot. They went up to the village of Beaumont-Hamel, where the guide says that the original catacombs, which were expanded by the Germans during the Great War, were used in previous centuries by refugees during the French religious wars, and that the Germans had improved and greatly enlarged the system. Then it talks about going up to Newfoundland Park. Today, of course, Newfoundland Park is still preserved, but when they saw it in 1928, there was many battlefield artefacts still there, lots of barbed wire, bits of shells and old rifles. The guide says that these artefacts were lying around everywhere, and that the whole appearance of the place brings back very vividly the days of 10 years ago. And from there, they made their way up to Tietvel. The guide says there is much of great interest to be seen, as there is today. They go past the Ulster Tower and look across to their left, where the Schwaben Redoubt was once situated on that ridge. And the guide then goes on to say, on reaching the top of the ridge, the road passes through the site of what was once the village of Tietvel. It says it's hardly possible to realise that a village once stood there. Every vestige of a building is levelled to the ground and the surface is pitted with shell holes. Most of the debris of war has been gathered up, but metal searchers are still digging about and salvaging war material. It says Tietvel may be regarded as a threshold to the Somme country, and the list of places within easy reach renowned not only for mud, but for undying heroism is unending. Poisier, Moquet Farm, Stuff Redoubt, Regina Trench were all within easy reach, but it will take most pilgrims all of their time to make out the tour described above, and now they should now retrace their steps to Beaucourt Station. What it doesn't mention in this description in 1928 is the Tietvel Memorial, because it wasn't there. It hadn't started, building hadn't started at this stage. Seems impossible to imagine Tietvel without the church, without the visitor centre, and without that splendid memorial to the missing. The pilgrimage then made their way to Vimy, and they didn't have to walk here because they'd hired what they called charabangs for those that couldn't walk the 2 miles from the railway station. It says that they can then follow the new road which had been constructed by the Canadian government for the purpose of conveying the material for building their great national memorial. And at this stage, the guide tells us that the only thing that was in place for the Vimy Memorial that we see today was the huge concrete base. It says that the magnitude of the work looked at from the northeast side is even now very impressive. And talking about the preserved trenches there that are filled in with concrete sandbags that we see today, it says to anyone who remembers those old sniping days, it's quite a pleasant change to stand in those saps and look over the top and leisurely observe the old German front line a few yards away with all its defensive armaments in position but with no defenders. And then it was to the Ypres salient. And often when I go there, I look at those fields and at those farms, which are now working farms again, and I think back, or I try and think back, to how it must have looked in 1917. And the guide contains a thought about it. It says, many a hamlet, many a farm, and even many a clump of trees unnamed before the war were christened with names that will never die. And although pounded and shattered and obliterated in that sea of mud, their names will live in history and will never be forgotten by those who, by their gallant struggles and wonderful endurance, succeeded in making them famous. And then it was to the city of Ypres itself and the ceremony of remembrance at the Menin Gate. The guide tells us that trains will begin arriving in Ypres shortly after 7 a.m. So they must have had an early start, mustn't they? And parties will be guided from the station to their respective assembly places where breakfast will be provided and they'll have the opportunity for a wash and brush up. Various public buildings in Ypres will be used for the disposal of pilgrims for the day. Several very fine schools, partially rebuilt barracks and the old prison will be utilised in this way. Part of the prison remains as it was at the end of the war, and those who assemble there will find themselves quite in the old war atmosphere. Special arrangements are being made to convey this to the ceremony by charabang, those pilgrims who are too incapacitated by wounds or age to take part in the march to the gate. On the conclusion of the march past, after the service, pilgrims will proceed to their respective assembly places and have lunch. And after this, they'll be able to make independent visits to the local places that they find interesting, including the Menin Gate itself. And then in capitals, it says, all pilgrims are asked to be particularly careful to concentrate at their appropriate assembly place at the time stated in the party timetables in order not to miss their train. In other words, don't get drunk and miss your train. And the various trains will leave Ypres between 4 and 8 p.m. No doubt many will wish to lay their personal tributes at the Menin Gate, and it gives them details of how they can obtain wreaths from the Legion. It concludes by talking about the causeway that goes across the moat around Ypres itself. And it says it's the real entrance to the salient. Across this causeway, during those 4 years, hundreds of thousands of gallant fellows marched out to the defence of all that we hold dear, many never to return home, and many whose bodies were never found, not even to be laid to rest by their comrades. It is on this causeway that the service of remembrance is to be held. A more fitting spot could be chosen at which to assemble members of the British Legion from far and near to pay their tribute of gratitude and affection and honoured memory to their fallen comrades. The booklet expresses the thoughts of these men in more details. It says the thoughts that will run through the minds of many standing by the gate will be in themselves an epitome of the world's toughest moments. Men who fought in the early days at Mons or at Hoog, Gullivelt, when the might of Germany was thundering down on Ypres, those who stood through the long trials of the second battle, or who partook in the momentary triumphs of the third, as well as those who passed in the final advance in the autumn of 1918, will be thinking of the times when they passed previously through the Menin Gate to go up to the attack, or on a raid, or working parties, or returning wounded, and a thousand other occasions of the daily life of war. Now one has a moment before the service begins to ponder over all those wonderful old times and to remember many a dear friend who one would long to have been present on this great day. In Ypres, every stone, every building will revive a memory. By the holding of this ceremony, the Legion will have given an inspiration to the generations yet to come. Now today, when we visit the beautiful Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries like Tynecott, especially during the summer months, we always notice the beautiful flowers and the English roses that cast a shadow over the graves of the fallen. And this wasn't lost on those pilgrims that went. The guide says, while the effect of the stonework of a war cemetery is no doubt striking, the whole structure is given life by the flowers. Those who have not seen the gardens which have been created as resting places for our soldiers, I would ask to imagine the tall cross and the white headstones rising out of green English lawns, the flowers forming a mass of colour on the graves. He then makes a prediction, or the booklet makes a prediction about the future. It says to the Legion members, above all, let no one fear that in the years to come, the graves will become uncared for. He was right about that, wasn't he? Because those cemeteries are just as beautiful now as what they were when these guys visited. He says that the governments of the empire will ensure that the cemeteries and memorials, while allowed to grow old gracefully, will be forever maintained on the present accepted standard of maintenance. And let everyone visiting the Western battlefields remember that these graves in France and Flanders contain but a part of the army of the empire's dead, and in paying homage to them, think of the great multitude of their fellows, scarcely less numerous, who died for the same cause and lie in every country of the world and all of its seas. Now, as we know, during the war, as the soldiers marched, they got great pleasure and camaraderie out of singing songs, famous songs, and they were encouraged to do this during the pilgrimage. The guide tells them there'll be moments when the pilgrimage, during the pilgrimage, when large numbers of the pilgrims will be together. At such periods, it may be that community songs will help pass the time of waiting. And in order to assist the memory, a few of the words of these songs are given here. And then they printed out the lyrics to many of those famous songs that we still recognise today. And in my mind's eye, I can see these soldiers gathering on railway platforms, waiting for their trains or hanging around in Ypres for the ceremony to start, and singing all together songs like this, just as they had done so on the country roads of France and Belgium as they made their way up to the front line more than 10 years ago. They're the songs like Take Me Back to Dear Old Blighty.
Take me back to dear old Blighty, put me on the train to London town. Take me over there, drop me anywhere, Liverpool, Leeds or Birmingham, well I don't care. I should love to see my best girl cuddling up again, we soon shall be. Whoa, tiddly in the IT, hurry me home to Blighty. Blighty is the place for me.
What about Australians?
Take me back to dear old Aussie. Put me on the boat to Wallabaloo. Take me over there, drop me anywhere, Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, for I don't care. I just want to see my best girl coming up again, we soon shall be. Whoa, Blighty is a failure, take me back to Australia, Aussie is the place for me. Take me back to dear old Canada, put me on the boat for old St. John. Take me over there, drop me anywhere, Toronto, Ottawa. my best girl. Coming up again with suits for me.
So what did the veterans themselves think of it? What were their thoughts after they came back? Well, let's find out, shall we? I'm sure that when any of us stand at the Menin Gate or beneath any of these memorials to the missing or in the beautiful cemeteries, we have the same thoughts and the same doubts that this veteran said. He said, as we stood in that great hall with the names of tens of thousands of those of our comrades who have no known burial place, inscribed on its panel walls, I saw nearby some of our womenfolk with tears gently rolling down their faces and a brave smile. I wondered whether the sacrifice had been worth it, whether the League of Nations and the Pact to Outlaw War would bear fruit, or whether our sons and daughters would be plunged into a struggle which our own great war would fade into insignificance. As the smile came, and as later in the ceremony the sun came forth in all its glory, so the hope of the former came in full strength, and we marched past our prince with the consciousness that we'd done our best, and come what may, posterity could point no finger of scorn at the present generation. And this is what, 1928, so 11 years later, his fears come true, and the world is plunged into a war that in many ways was much more damaging. There was a William Barnes from Burnley, and he was one of three men from that small town that went on the pilgrimage in 1928. When he came home, he was interviewed by a journalist from the Burnley Express. And for him, the pilgrimage was very personal because he went off to Plook Street, where his brother, John Barnes, who'd served with the 1st Battalion of the East Lancs, had been killed in November of 1914. He laid a wreath there, but his brother has no known grave. But he went to a cemetery where many of his brother's comrades were buried, and he said, close by is a cottage known as Lancashire Cottage, which during the war was the headquarters of the East Lancs. The man who tenanted the cottage during the war is still in occupation, and he told me that he would always remember the lads from Lancashire. If any visited the spot where he lived, he would be most welcome. William lived to be 93 years old, and he died in 1978. Now, it wasn't just the United Kingdom where pilgrims came from. They came from all over the Commonwealth, in particular Australia, New Zealand and Canada. There was a man called Selby Boa. He was one of those that came over and was 23 years old when he joined the Australian Imperial Force in November of 1914. He served at Gallipoli and was wounded at Passchendaele in 1917. He was evacuated to the London War Hospital in Epsom in Surrey, and whilst he was being treated there, he met a lady called Lydia. They fell in love and they got married. And when he went to the battlefield in 1928 with the Legion, he was remembering his brother and his cousin that had died during the conflict. But maybe the trip was worth it, the long trip from Australia. This is what he said. I would not have missed it for anything. It will live in my memory as long as I live. About 11,000 people made the pilgrimage, every class and creed, some of the highest and some of the lowest in the land, all there to visit the battlefields and the graves of their dead. It made one realise the war brought everyone level, all suffered alike. The towns in the war are now rebuilt, and a good proportion of the battlefields are cultivated and growing crops. Wild flowers and scarlet poppies are growing on every side. Roads have been remade and everything looks prosperous. No mud to be seen anywhere as you go through the trenches, so different to the grim days of conflict. The French people turned out in their thousands to give us a welcome. They cheered, waved and gesticulated, and when a little rank of blinded men marched by, arm in arm, the roar went up that could be heard for miles. Now, it wasn't just his relatives that Bauer would have been thinking about, because when he returned to Australia, the local newspaper told us a little bit more about what he went through. He'd said he'd served at Poitiers on the Somme, but finally at Ypres, a 12-inch German Mannenwerfer shell burst near where he and nine of his comrades were standing. All the rest were killed, the sergeant alone escaping, though with a badly damaged foot. Though at first his recovery was despaired of, 6 months in hospital made a very big difference. especially the devoted care and attention of one excellent English nurse, who subsequently became Mrs. Bower. When he returned to Australia, it says that the sergeant's leg is 3 inches shorter than the other one, and he was due to undergo an operation to have the bones reset and lengthened. And he said that during his time in the trenches, never did he have the chance to get into a hand-to-hand contest. He said the Germans either ran or threw up their hands. Then there was Archibald Candler, better known as Archie, of course, and he was with the Coldstream Guards, a regular soldier who'd been serving since 1905, and he was previously been a musician. He'd been severely wounded at Sanctuary Wood in September of 1915 and was discharged in May 1916. And when he returned from the Great Pilgrimage, he was interviewed by the local paper, the Bury Free Press. And this is what he said. "It is marvellous how they've cultivated the land around. There are big shell holes that have never been filled up. And in the middle of the wheat fields, you can see those big cement redoubts built by the Germans, gun emplacements and so on, which are so substantial, nearly a yard thick, and they'll never be able to shift them. The people there are rebuilding their own houses at night time, after they've done their day's work. Some are living in the front, and the backs are all blown out. The majority are in our army huts and corrugated iron built up for shelter, so they're in a position to build proper houses. Barbed wire is still about, and some of the women tore their stockings and skirts on it." Now, everyone had been warned in the booklet by the Legion that they should behave when in France and Belgium and to pay respect to the locals that were so welcoming. And that was the case, because Archie tells us when they went up to Vimy Ridge, he says, "We went all around the ridge and through the trenches, and here and there dud shells were sticking up, and there was a few rifles lying around. In the evening, we were entertained to an open-air concert with bands. We visited some of the cafes, and there were 450 of us, but not a man was the worse for drink. The way it was conducted and the way people behaved themselves was splendid." When he was at the Menin Gate, he looked up and he saw the names of many of his mates from the 2nd Battalion of the Suffolks. And he brought a couple of souvenir ashtrays, one from Hill 60 and another ashtray shaped in as the Menin Gate. In 1935, Archie became chairman of the Bury St Edmunds branch of the Legion, and he died in 1960 at his home in Bury. And then Captain Arthur Cleal, he'd been commissioned in 1916 and after the war became chairman of the Chelmsford branch of the Legion. And he was there in 1928. And he said it was an experience that he'll never forget. He says, to put it into a few words, "I've never had such a 4 days in all of my life. Everything was done that could be done, both by the headquarters organisation and the municipal authorities. And the solemnity of the occasion was a dominant note. The mayors of the different places extended both hands of welcome and friendship, and public buildings were thrown open to us. Our visit to Vimy Ridge impressed us all. There were still signs of the war to remind us of those sleeping in the cemeteries and what their comrades went through. At Ypres, the great service of remembrance was most touching. Many of the war-stricken villages have made wonderful recoveries, but the people in them still remember Tommy for what he was in the war, and they opened their doors in welcome." But as I said earlier, it wasn't just the veterans that were there. It was widows there and mothers and all sorts of other relations as well. There was a Mrs. Flora Sharp from Bury St Edmunds, and she got the opportunity to visit the grave of her husband, Company Sergeant Major Charles Sharp, who died while serving with the 7th Battalion of the Suffolk Regiment. He died in October of 1915 after being admitted to a casualty clearing station. And he was another one of those regular soldiers, having served 23 years with the Suffolk Regiment. And she told the local paper, she said, "I've come back with more content now that I've seen my husband's grave. And if it is any comfort to other mothers that I've seen the graves of their sons too, it would be to me, and they can rest assured that every cemetery I saw is well kept, and it is like entering a pretty English garden." And that's exactly what the commission wanted those cemeteries to look like, and what they still look like to this day. And Flora, she lived to a grand old age of 83 before she died in 1962. And another unnamed veteran said, in conclusion, "In the past, week on this pilgrimage, I've rubbed shoulders with members of the Legion from all parts of the country, men broken in limb and health but not in spirit, for the defence of what they believe to be right, men who have missed death and disaster miraculously, and thank God for it, men who have touched the borderline of eternity and, in their own phrase, got away with it. So now let's look at what happened when we did recreate that tour in August of 2018. Well, my most outstanding memory of this tour was the weather. It was the first time that I'd been on a organised battlefield tour as a guide, and for years whilst I've been guiding small groups of people, I said there's no way I'm doing a coach tour, and there I was on one of the biggest coach tours ever to be put on anywhere on the Western Front, organised superbly by Ledger Battlefield Tours. There was many of us on this trip that were doing our first tour for Ledger, and it was brilliantly organised, just as the Legion had done all those years before. But I mentioned the weather. It was absolutely roasting for the 2 days that we toured the battlefields. I think it was about the late 30s, 37, 38 degrees, something like that. The car park in the visitor centre at Vimy Ridge was actually melting, and some of the coaches, I think we had 50 or 60 coaches, they couldn't actually use the car park. But no one complained. They all knew why they were there. And then on the third day, when everyone was suited and booted, thankfully the weather relented. The weather was cloudy, and it made it much more comfortable for the 1,100 standard bearers that were going to take part in the ceremony that morning. And for one of the passengers on my coach, it was an extremely special event. I suppose it was for all of them, but for one in particular, he was travelling with his daughter, but he was suffering from incurable cancer. And over the course of the 2 days that we were touring the battlefields, his health got worse. But he was the standard bearer for his branch, and he was determined to take part in the ceremony. And he did. He carried the standard in his arms whilst his daughter pushed him in the wheelchair. And immediately the ceremony had finished, Ledger made arrangements for him to return home. But I'll never forget what he said to me. He said that all through his life he wanted to see the battlefields, and he realised this was going to be the last opportunity that he had to do that, and it meant the absolute world to him to be able to try and understand what these men went through. And we both cried, as did his daughter, and then off he went, and he sadly died just a few weeks later. But it's being able to take people to the battlefields like him that makes guiding so special to me and to everybody else that does it. And after his death, I received a very lovely email from his daughter. So what did it mean to those pilgrims in the year 2018? Well, we started off by listening to a couple of those accounts. Let's hear a few more as the modern members of the Royal British Legion tell them why this pilgrimage was so important to them and their families.
The volume I'm holding now is a compilation of letters that a father wrote to his parents during the war. This particular one was written in October 1915, and he writes home, "Dear mother, father and all, we've just come out after three of the most terrible days in fighting we've known. It was, to use a Tommy's expression, hell with the lid off. Having said that, I'm in the pink of condition, and do give my love to all from your loving soldier son, Leslie." But then finally, his commanding officer, Lieutenant Gray, had to censor the letter, and he writes this: "As your son's company officer, I have to censor his letter. He'd read very little about his own doings. He worked extraordinarily well, and by his own example, encouraged his men to hold on at the barricade for nearly 24 hours until finally relieved. It's owing to his exertions we managed to hold our ground at that particular point. And it was because of this that he eventually received the military medal about a year later."
This particular picture of the family home in Redditch in Archer Road, and you can probably can see it's frayed at the top there. He was carrying this on the 27th of October 1917, when unfortunately he was killed. And a piece of shrapnel went through the breast pocket of his uniform.
I came to be involved in the Great Pilgrims 90 event due to my granddad. He's been, for as long as I can remember, working with the Royal British Legion, raising money for the Poppy Appeal. I remember going into Henley see him dancing about in his World War I outfit.
When I think of it, we're sitting here in the garden in South Oxfordshire. Next week, we'll be there with thousands of people there. And it'll be the real thing.
Yeah. I was thinking about my father most of the time. Did he go down that field? Was he in that wood? I went up towards the memorial and I took one or two photos in exactly the same spot my father took as well. And walking through, seeing all the graves on the other side, that's what I was thinking of.
Mainly just shocking for me. I'd say maybe in a couple of weeks it'll sink in a bit more because there's so much to take in such a short amount of time. But even to be around here with all the graves, it hits home about the amount of people that were affected by it and how this many people went through what they went through.
This is my uncle's grave, my dad's twin brother. Royal Garrison Artillery. He was killed on the 27th of October, 1917, age 21. I thought I'd put this poppy cross down with the signatures down saying GP90, August the 8th, which is obviously going to be tomorrow, 2018. Which I will place just there.
And then we reach the actual day of the procession itself, the 8th of August, and we got the thoughts of those people that were taking part in the ceremony just before the ceremony started.
Coming here and seeing where my great-granddad fought, wearing his medals today, representing our family and just being proud of all the struggles he went through and what he did.
There's a certain amount of trepidation, how far have we got to march with the standards, but the weather's kind to us and I'm sure it'll be a tremendous event. And looking around here now, surrounded by hundreds of standards, there's a tremendous buzz. And I think everyone here knows that this particular event will never be repeated. So we're seeing some sort of history, and I hope it's recorded by people like you so that we can see down the years what really happened on this day, and we're very proud to be part of that.
Father doing this 90 years ago today. It means to me I've just walked in my father's footsteps.
The parade through Ypres was an amazing experience. We were told before we left where we were walking was the actual way the troops walked through the Menin Gate. Not many of them came back. We've come back because of them, we're here. Today has been a huge success. So bravo to the Royal British Legion, and we look forward to the next 100 years and do it again.
Brother Bertie went away to do his bit the other day. With a smile on his lips and his lieutenant bits upon his shoulder, bright and gay. As the train moved out, he said, remember me to all the birds. Then he wagged his paw and went away to war, shouting out these pathetic words. Goodbye, goodbye, wipe the tear, baby dear, from your eye. Though it's hard to part, I know I'll be tickled to death to go. Don't cry, don't sigh. There's a silver lining in the sky. Bounce far, old Finn, cheerio, chin, chin. Now move to the little goodbye. Goodbye, goodbye. Wipe the tear, baby dear, from your eye. Though it's hard to part, I know I'll be tickled to death to go. Don't cry, don't sigh. There's a silver lining in the sky. Bonsoir, old
Makes me feel very emotional now when I look back at those experiences. What was it now? Five and a half years ago. We told many stories as we made our way around the battlefields. Stories on Hill 60, stories on the Somme, stories at Arras. Many of the stories that I've told in some of these podcasts. I told those stories with tears in my eyes. It was a privilege and an honour to be part of GP90. It was an experience that no one who was there in August 2018 will ever forget. And I won't ever forget it either. So once again, thank you very much for tuning in to this podcast. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed recording it. It really does open my eyes up and bring back memories from tours that I've done in the past and stories that I've uncovered. And it'd be really helpful if you could rate and review this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get it from. It helps spread the word to other people. And next week will be Christmas. So I thought I would record a podcast about the famous Christmas truce, and that's what I've done. But we're not going to look at it from an historical point of view because that's been covered by so many proper historians, professional historians. I didn't want to cut across anything that they've done. So I've looked at the individual accounts that have been published, or some have been published, and some I've found from primary sources. And I put together a special podcast, which I hope you'll tune into next week. But in the meantime, we're going to remember all of those veterans that went on the original Royal British Legion Grand Pilgrimage, Great Pilgrimage of 1928. None of those men are around now. So we'll remember them, and we'll also remember the people that went in 2018, following in the footsteps of those pilgrims from 100 years ago. Some, like the man on my coach, are no longer with us. We remember them as well by playing The Last Post.